You know you rock when you roll with the Seahawks. Marshawn Lynch, beast mode with his dreadlocks. Wilson passes the ball to the end zone, touchdown. You know we're gonna get the crown in Super Bowl 24. Team, we get the ring, the bling, listen to the crowd sing. Seahawks, Seahawks, Seahawks. We block that offense to say we'll lose is such an offense and nonsense. We got the best defense, being the other quarterback comes with the expense of the act of being sacked. I hope the Broncos have enough time to react to the level of game the Hawks are bringing that evening, a Super Bowl Sunday, cause they're gonna go all the way for the win, starting when the game begins, all the way to the end of the game, and to go down in fame as the Super Bowl champions of this year. This team should be feared.
You better saddle up when you roll with Seattle. Broncos seem like some old cattle left in the field after cut.
Oh, yes. To the Hawks, just kick a pee. Just Lil Hoagie, the Rashad Penny to K-Dudes, Chris Carson. Welcome to the No Point Conversion, everyone. I'm Luke Burbank. It's Andrew Walsh right over there. Hello, my friend.
Hello. Hello.
I said this on TBTL. And in fact, I would imagine if someone is a diehard Minnesota Vikings fan, this is probably not the week they're going to be tuning into the No Point. But you know, peace and love to our Vikings fans. I take no joy in beating the Minnesota Vikings because I love people from Minnesota and I love that franchise. Other than when we are playing them, and all I could think last night—that's not true. I could think about a lot of things last night, but something that was in my mind and on my mind was I was so excited about the Seahawks doing well, and I was also so sad about our friend the Stubot and other friends of ours and listeners who are, you know, Minnesota fans, because our joy was their sadness, and I did not enjoy that feeling.
Yes, and, you know, no offense to our Green Bay Packers fans, but I have no problem celebrating a Packers loss, especially if it's at the hands of one of my teams. I do take delight in that, but I agree.
See, that's
with you
weird,
because
I also take no joy. I mean, in a way I should, because you could make the argument that Green Bay has elements of being sort of the Yankees of football. Not that they're, you know, like the richest team or whatever, but just like they're always in the sort of, they get a lot of nationally televised games. You know, they get a lot of attention, I think deservedly so. So that's usually the kind of team I'm not going to like. I think it has to do with the fan ownership part, even if that's somewhat ceremonial or whatever. And just, I don't know, I just love people from Wisconsin too. So now if you're a Cowboys fan, kick rocks.
We don't have any of those left, trust me.
Yeah. Well, newly minted Dallas fan, Nick Jarin. Maybe.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh,
anyway, so Seahawks win 37-30. They beat the Vikings. Some sort of pretty interesting stats, mostly related to Kirk Cousins. Now 0-8 on Monday Night Football, the worst record in the history of Monday Night Football.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, it's just very few people get to play. Very few quarterbacks are good enough to get to play in 8 Monday Night Football games, but bad enough that they don't win any of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not even fair to Cousins, though. I was listening to a lot of sports talk this morning, and one of the things that was being brought up, and I actually think that this is a decent point, is I think if I were a Vikings fan, I'd be pretty mad at Mike Zimmer today, the coach of the Vikings, over just some very tentative play calling, it would seem. Like, they really just didn't let Kirk Cousins do much. They the way that the game was called, it was just a ton of checkdowns, a ton of like short passes to the tight ends and various receivers. And Kirk Cousins is interception prone, and I do think he's overpaid and all of those things. But it, like, and then particularly when Dalvin Cook went down with an injury, it was like they just didn't. It felt, I would be mad at the what seemed to be very conservative play calling by the Vikings.
Yeah, if he doesn't get injured, do you think that we still win the game?
Boy, that's a real, it's going to be a different game. I mean, it was, let's just start at the beginning, a very good place to start. You know, the Seahawks, they come out and they're actually driving okay on the Vikings. You know, they take the kickoff. And then they have this moment that I just thought was, I mean, later it would be erased by the fake punt. But in the moment, I was just livid at Pete Carroll, as I was letting you and everyone else in the Eagles know. At one point, you said something like, everybody just be careful about your language, because I think between me and Durs, there was going to be some swears flying. And I don't think that really goes over well at the Eagles.
Yes, there's supposedly a no swearing policy at the Eagles, and you know that's everything's taken with a grain of salt there. But at one point, like Andy was just like shouting the F. I think you guys were both like shouting various S and F words, and I was kind of like, that's going to get us in trouble. While, by the way, three of us are holding a table with like 12 chairs at it, and everybody's like a little bit like, why are these guys all sitting in front and not letting us use these other tables? So that was a little
because of freaking Tim and his disc golf.
Anyway,
I was livid at Pete Carroll for that punt call, and it just felt like I didn't think like the game is lost at that point, but I just felt I was annoyed that I felt like we were just kind of going by this script that we follow, and that Pete Carroll is just a very conservative for being such a kind of like, you know, enthusiastic kind of slightly outside the box coach in terms of his demeanor. He's very inside the box of field position, and he really just lives by this you know, basically make them go as far as possible, flip the field, punt it, don't take dumb chances. Anyway, but that was frustrating because, of course, we stall out. We punt it on a play where Carson looks like he might be hurt, which was also kind of a bummer, although he was ultimately fine. But it's like you punt it, and then the Vikings turn around and just put together a really impressive drive. And they erase that punt in like two plays. It was like a 35-yard run, which involved an unusually bad tackle by K.J. Wright, known for his Weston Washington Hyundai dealer ads, but also known for his usually sure tackling. And he just did a weird thing where he just sort of hit the guy and didn't wrap him up, and then the guy ran for 35 yards. So I was, as you would say, pretty rip shit after that first drive. Mm-hmm. How were you feeling at the beginning of the game, other than the stress of trying to save 12 seats?
I have a weird optimism with the Seahawks. But it's not weird. It makes sense. Like and also, even, you know, over the years that I've been watching them, they have a reputation for being a come from behind team, winning in the fourth quarter kind of team. You know, it would be fun if we didn't always wait until the fourth quarter to win. But so I always have this sort of faith that, you know, in the first three quarters of any game, I still believe that they can come back and win. So I was equally frustrated about punting at the 49-yard line. That made no sense to me. When they did get that touchdown immediately, it did not feel good, obviously. But I was not like saying the game is over. I don't know if you were there thinking like, oh, you know, with this kind of play calling or whatever, we're in trouble. I remember pretty early on, because I think then after that touchdown, I think we score on our next drive. That's probably wrong. I'm bad at remembering things.
No, we did.
Okay, I loved seeing how we were running the game. Like, I loved, like, the running backs were both firing, and so I loved that they were sticking with the run so much and not abandoning it and just being like, this is working for us right now, let's keep doing it. And so I loved the way the offense started playing after that.
Yeah, it was, and I think Minnesota has a decent run defense, so that was pretty encouraging. And it was like, I mean, Rashad Penny has kind of come into his own at exactly the right time, because Chris Carson's taken a lot of snaps. That was another stat they flashed. I think that he is taking like 21 snaps a game, which is the, like, Marshawn Lynch was doing that in his heyday. It's like a lot of reps per game for a guy. So he's, you know, he's getting kind of banged up. And so having Rashad Penny, and they're just different styles of runner. I think I get the sense Penny's a little bit faster. And still pretty bruiser. I mean, he's a thick boy, but it's like, I just think it's probably disoriented the defense to have those two guys, you know, coming at you, and they're different styles. And so that was really encouraging, that even when Chris Carson looked like he was hurt, I was bummed, but I was like, well, Penny's doing pretty well. And that drive, like, I didn't think we were going to lose the game when Minnesota drove the field that first time, because it was, like I said, it was that kind of fluky 35-yard play really helped them. I definitely felt like if we come out and we three and out, you know, the next drive, and then they go up 14-0, that's going to get ugly fast. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we then drove the field and tied it at 7, that was huge. Then I was more just absolutely perplexed at that play by Russell Wilson, where he volleyballed it back.
Oh yeah.
To the Vikings, I don't even know which guy it was, but it was, you know, it looked like probably a cornerback or safety, who then ran it into the end zone for the touchdown. I've never gotten a full ruling on that. I guess he was trying to knock it down, but since he was falling, it ended up knocking it up. I mean, my first thought was he's just trying to extend the play because he's Russell Wilson, but I never actually got clarification on that. Did you see anything else about that?
No. And you know what? I wonder what he said about it after the game, or even what Pete said about it in his ESPN radio interview today. That would have been interesting because, I mean, I know the announcer said he was trying to knock it down. But again, knowing Russell Wilson and having watched him, it definitely seemed like he is a guy who seems like you're certain that the play is totally dead, but then he'll do a little shovel pass or pull off some miracle to actually get a first down. And so this looked like a play that was absolutely disastrous. And then when he kind of volleys it, like you say, it still feels to me, and I rewatched that clip today, it still feels to me like there's part of him that is trying to get it to a receiver, which I don't even know. Would that be an eligible receiver? Does it not matter because it's behind the line of scrimmage? I don't know how that stuff works. But I don't know. Maybe he was trying to knock it down. It didn't feel that way.
Yeah, it felt like if he was trying to knock it down, I don't think he had a real clear plan in his mind, but I think he was trying to extend the play because he batted it up into the air. And I just think that he can't turn that off, which is kind of cool. And I will say this. You really notice the difference between him and Kirk Cousins, even though Kirk Cousins had comparable stats coming in. The difference of, like, if they start to get to Kirk Cousins, if he's flushed at all, it's like bad news. And if you flush Russell Wilson, you're actually potentially in a worse position as a defense. And so, like, sometimes, you know, just you forget how amazing Russell Wilson is because you see him week in and week out until you see a more conventional quarterback dealing with some of the same stuff. And you're just like, oh, my God. Like, yeah, he's amazing. So even when he does something dingus like that, you kind of got to just, like, even like when he overthrew Hollister at Philly and threw like 15 yards over his head, you just have to kind of go, well, that's going to happen because it's like he's just so good so much of the time. Although I will say this game was not statistically his strongest. But another thing they were saying on sports radio today was that's kind of good. This is a team that, believe it or not, is really built around the idea of running. And if Russell Wilson doesn't have to have MVP numbers every game for us to win, that's a positive development for us. Mm-hmm. You know, seasons where it's all just because Russell Wilson has somehow managed to just hoist us on his back like a papoose and carry us to the win. Those are really not actually the best games for us. It's better to have some balance.
He threw one interception yesterday, but I'm having trouble remembering.
Well that was an interception that he batted.
Right, of course, that was the one, and then right, and so that results in a touchdown right there immediately, right? So that's his one interception, right? And then
I believe so,
and then we also had an interception, and then we ended. I like to think about turnovers. I believe we ended the game with a turnover as well. We got the ball back on a when the Vikings fumbled a catch, I believe, right?
Yeah, we. I think it was. I don't have the number in front of me, but. I think we won the turnover battle by one turnover, or maybe it was more than that because we had Trey Flower. There was the fumble that led to the injury of Dalvin Cook. Although they thought Dalvin Cook might actually, his shoulder was bothering him at the end of the first half, and so it was already kind of on the way towards that. But there was this play where the Vikings fumble and Dalvin Cook is down. And Stephon Diggs, their best receiver, is also down. Now, Stephon Diggs came back in, but it was like that was one of those moments where I was really hurting for Stu because it's like your best receiver and your best running back are both down on a play that was a turnover. It's like it doesn't get worse than that.
Right.
Luckily, Diggs was okay. I don't know what the story on Dalvin Cook is. But yeah, so we got that fumble. That was an amazing interception by Trey Flowers, which I've been a Trey Flowers skeptic. But he certainly seemed like he played pretty well this game. That pick was kind of amazing. So, yeah, maybe you have it. I don't know how – my memory is – and then there was that fumble at the end. Malik Turner caused a fumble, which was, I think, recovered by Travis Homer, who had a real
– Oh, right.
It's a real great way to have your first touch in an NFL game is a fake punt.
Yes.
Which was – I wasn't paying – I was running around – getting Doritos and nervously pacing in the back. I don't think I fully grasped that we were on like our 20 or something with that fake punt or our 30. Like that was really deep in our territory, which is probably part of why it worked because that's a very gutsy play coming from Pete Carroll. And I do not, obviously Minnesota did not expect it.
And if I recall, we only needed about 2 yards, but we got a lot, but homie got a lot more than that. That was my Marge.
That was a good Marge. There was a whole round of of Simpsons-related humor that swept through the Eagles after that play. Yeah, I think he got like 25-plus yards, which was really cool. There was I rewatched it today, and there was this moment. I'm just so sort of – because the Seahawks have had such fumble problems this year, every time a play comes to an end, I'm nervous about a fumble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Homer's – like this is his first touch in an NFL game. His adrenaline is going. He runs down the field, and instead there's a moment where he could go out. Instead of going out, he just bashes into a guy. He doesn't gain any extra yards. And it was like the exactly the kind of play where you might fumble because it was a really hard hit. And you're just not used to holding the football in an NFL game, being hit by NFL defensive players. He didn't obviously fumble, but I was like, that would have been our luck. But so
yeah, I think all of our... All of us were clinging to our seats without using our hands when Carson got that run and was tackled. Right, was he at the 1 or 2 yard line or something? And I think he got tackled from behind, and we're all just like, "Oh no, it's good, it's happening again!" But he held on to it.
Yeah, we're like, it's like it's weird because it almost seems like he's in the most danger when he's breaking a big play because he gets out there. And somebody was saying. I think it might have been my brother Sammy at Thanksgiving, which I'd never thought of it this way, but he was saying that part of why Carson is effective is because how he holds the ball, so he's able to get momentum because he kind of holds the ball away from his body. And if you think about it, if you're swinging your arms, like if you're running and you're just like holding the ball against your chest, that's not how humans were really meant to run. Mm-hmm. And so it probably kind of messes with your biodynamics and your momentum and all of those things. And so Carson... The way he runs and why he hits the hole hard and why he's effective is probably because of how he's holding the ball, but that also, of course, puts that ball in danger.
Yeah. This was, and I know that I can say this because my rooting interest is in the team that won, but this was a good game. I mean, this ended up being a high-scoring game. Stu texted us when I think it was maybe like 14-10 or something. He's like, oh, I was expecting this to be a higher-scoring game. Or maybe it was actually right before that that pick six by the Vikings. And he said, I thought this was going to be a more high-scoring game than this is. And then from that point forward, it did become a high-scoring game, and it, you know, we only won by a touchdown, which on reflection, upon reflection, it didn't feel that way to me. Once the Seahawks were still in it, and again, I guess I just had blind faith. It wasn't until this morning I'm looking at the score, I'm like, I wasn't as nervous as maybe I should have been in the last, let's say, 10 minutes of this game.
Well, I mean, we were up 34-17. We had this like 24-point explosion. And so you're up 34-17 in the, I believe, the fourth quarter maybe, at the beginning of the fourth quarter. I mean, that just seems kind of insurmountable. But then we had the DK fumble. We left one of their guys uncovered where, you know, we had that great David Moore play where they kind of had a busted coverage and Xavier Rhodes was over on the sideline doing his best Myles Garrett impression, minus hitting someone, but he had his helmet off and was swinging it. So, I mean, I could see why you felt confident. I mean, I honestly felt like this is turning into a shellacking at 34-17. I just thought we can't possibly lose this game. And then, you know, we did kind of, we didn't finish strong. And then we got lucky too that they missed that extra point, which really changed the complexion of like the drive they needed at the end, because instead of it being just for a field goal, it was of course for 4 points. So, I was, you know, I'm not trying to bring this up to be like pat myself on the back, but I kind of had a feeling going into the second half that, I mean, football, it's just like the ball will usually kind of, you'll get some lucky bounces and you won't. And we were getting no lucky bounces in the first half. And I was just like, we're going to get some bounces. And we kind of did in the second half, which really helped us, obviously. But yeah, we did not really, it felt like we were destroying them. And then I looked up and I was like, oh, this is a one score game. Oh, shit. If they get the ball here and drive the field, we lose, which was like a weird experience because it just seemed like we were, after basically that first drive, it seemed like we were kind of, or the first scoring drive for us, it seemed like we were sort of in control of the game.
And also Rudolph, I can't remember, whatever.
Kyle Rudolph.
Yeah, that Kyle Rudolph catch, I believe is the last touchdown for the Vikings.
That was like incredible. Some Odell Beckham shit.
Yes, I know. The Odell Beckham of old. I've heard stories about that Odell Beckham. I'd love to see it someday. But that was an amazing catch. So I'll tell you what, like if the roles were reversed and the Seahawks were playing – from behind the way the Vikings were, and to get a catch like that in the end zone, I would, as a Seahawks fan, be like, oh, we got this. Russell's going to do some more magic. And Kirk Cousins just doesn't have that kind of magic in late in the game.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think I probably am under – I'm sort of underestimating Kirk Cousins because he's a weirdo with a tube of death rocks by his house. But – I think he's better. I mean, his stats are pretty good. And look, the team, they're now 8-4. Is that their record? I mean, they've had a good season, and I hope that I wasn't unduly harsh on them saying they didn't scare me. I was feeling a little scared after that first drive, I'll admit. Mm-hmm. But also, the thing about the Seahawks is, to their credit, they just, and this is where I think your optimism kind of comes from, it's like they just do this thing where they just kind of slowly adjust. So the Vikings never really had another drive like that. I mean, they did have a couple big plays, but like that kind of just dominance, that just moving the ball at will, it just wasn't like that after that first drive, and it was just because like some adjustments that were made. And that's something the Seahawks have been pretty good at over the years under Pete Carroll.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have a lot of hot takes on this game, but I will just say what I said before, which is really loved seeing the Penny Carson duo on the ground, and hopefully that'll continue in the last few games here.
Yeah, I mean, that was such a huge game for the Seahawks because it was the difference between being really in the driver's seat for the playoffs. We're now, I think, we're slightly ahead in the NFC West because we have the same record as the Niners, but we have so far we've beat them. So that's, you know, that stat is slightly misleading because we still have to play them again. But if we have, yeah, so then I actually don't know how that works. If we end up with the exact same record as the Niners and we split the season matchup, I think that goes to conference schedule or out of conference schedule. There's some weird way they decide it. But this was like, if we lost this game, we were going to be the number 6 seed. And if we won it, we were going to be the number 2 seed as of right now. So it was a huge swing for us and a very, just a relief. I get so worried when the announcers are talking about the Seahawks dominance on Monday Night Football and of the Vikings, like the way we've dominated the Vikings of late. It always just feels like, well, this is going to end at some point, and you've just hastened it, Joe Tessitore, Booger McFarland.
So up next is one other quick thought I guess I would have was, we just don't see Tyler Lockett the way we used to. Is he still getting over something?
Yeah, well, he was injured. Okay. Oh, so it's two things. One, he was injured, you know, a couple weeks ago, and he had to go to the hospital because they were worried about swelling.
Right, yeah.
But he was actually, this is kind of interesting, he actually, like, had, I think, the flu. And they didn't tell anyone.
Yeah.
And so he was sick, but they didn't want to tell anyone because they used him as a decoy. They only targeted him one time that I can remember. But this is actually kind of interesting. I think there's too much, like, NFL head coaches being weirdly secretive, and it's like, get over yourselves. But this is one case where it's like, you really don't want the other team to know that Tyler Lockett's like not actually really able to catch the ball and do much because he's sick. So they didn't tell anyone, and they ran him out there just to draw attention from the defense, which then opened up Hollister, which, by the way, that's an emerging storyline. Hollister was the most targeted Seahawk yesterday, and it's clear that Russell Wilson really likes that dude.
Yeah, yeah. I was very excited about Disley, too. Remember, Disley was good.
Yes, old man Disley.
Yeah, and so when Hollister came out, I'm like, I don't know who this guy is, but Hollister has been something. Now, Hollister, I don't think, had a touchdown, but he's had touchdowns the past couple of days. Maybe, did he get a touchdown? No, Moore got the catch, and then I think it was a couple of Pennies and a Carson, I think.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Hollister had a game where he made his first catch as a Seahawk, and he had two touchdowns. Yeah. That was a huge game for us and for him. But I love Disley, and it's a real bummer because Disley, when he's been healthy, you know, he's been on the Seahawks for two seasons, and in both cases, he's been incredible. And then he has these, like, catastrophic injuries. I guess you could say, luckily, his second catastrophic injury is different than his first one, I think. And so at least he's not re-injuring the same, like, he's not re-tearing the same ACL or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about Disley that's interesting was they drafted him for his blocking. I don't think that the thought was he's going to be this, like, sick receiver, but he's actually really good. So hopefully he'll come back full strength. But in the interim, this Hollister thing has been a really nice development. He's just, like, he's not big. He's not as big as, like, a Luke Wilson. He's almost more like a kind of more of a – he's a very big receiver. And but that means he's faster in the open field. So if Russell can hit him in stride, he really gets going. He can pick up some yards after the catch. So
Yeah.
So this has been a very as I was listening to sports radio, actually last night as I was driving home and listening to the postgame show and just in a complete state of delight. Isn't it funny? I know we talk about this sometimes, like when your team wins, just all like ESPN, all the highlights. It's just all gravy. It's just like there's nothing you want to watch more. And when they lose, it's just like, get this bitter taste out of my mouth.
Yeah. So, what football? I don't even watch football.
Exactly.
I'm some Terry Gross.
I'm rollerblading the pain away.
That's right.
As I was listening, the postgame show driving home and just delighting in it, it occurred to me that we are in a very blessed moment as Seahawks fans. I mean, the team has been good. The team has won a Super Bowl since you and I started following it together. But this is like, to be 10-2 is a real thing, is a real accomplishment in the NFL in this day and age. Like, they're on a run right now that it's pretty, it's not your average season. I mean, luckily, of late, even an average season for the Seahawks has still been over 500. You know, they're still competitive. They're relevant. Russell Wilson's fun to watch. But this is a very special time to be a Seahawks fan.
Yeah, especially considering last year's kind of quasi, not rebuild, but kind of like a lot of question marks last year about a lot of new personnel and who is this team, a lot of talk about like that.
Legion of whom?
Yes. Now, do we know what was their record last year? They defied expectations. I know that. But then seeing that just in 2 years, what they've become
We went maybe 11-5 last year. But yeah, it was. I mean, the whole thing was this team's identity was really the defense and the Legion of Boom. And then as you slowly lost a bunch of those guys and then lost Earl Thomas, it was just like, you know, what is the identity of this team? And definitely, I think the Quandre Diggs pickup has made a huge difference. Like, he put a really, really hard hit last night on Irv Smith Jr., who's a big tight end for Minnesota. So I think that I think that the improved defense, although I don't know if 30 points is a lot of points to give up. Although in their defense, six of those or seven of those was because of Russell Wilson's volleyball activities. But like, I think that the resurgence of our defense has been two things. Well, it's been three things. It's been Jadeveon Clowney continuing to be a problem, which I think has kind of given Ziggy Ansah some opportunities. And then I think the addition of Diggs. So I think that we can run. I'm getting way out of my depth here, but my sense is with Diggs being more solid at the safety, we can actually like rush more because we don't have to drop everybody back in coverage to make up for the fact that, you know, our secondary isn't so hot. And that means more pressure on the quarterback. So I think a lot of it has to do with Quandre Diggs.
Just to set the record straight, Seahawks were 10-6 last year. That was their final.
Right. That was considered a kind of a better than expected year because of the fact that we were just basically totally starting over with our defense in a lot of ways. Another thing, I don't, again, have the stats right in front of me, but we had very few penalties yesterday. Did we have no holding penalties?
I don't think we did. Now that you say
that's amazing.
That say that.
And that was a game changer. Now, did we hold? Of course. In fact, on Chris Carson's, if were I the Stubot or another Minnesota fan, I would be livid that on Chris Carson's touchdown, I believe it was, I don't know if it was Hollister or Metcalf, one of them was blocking for him and just clearly had the Minnesota guy just like locked up, you know, holding him by the sort of chest pads or whatever. So I'm not saying we didn't hold, but we didn't get flagged for holding very much. And that was huge because, you know, we get in these games where we have like 10 holding penalties and you're just constantly behind the sticks. We didn't have that happen yesterday. They weren't calling it for some reason, which was awesome for us.
Yeah. And again, it was kind of a fun, knowing that I'm saying this with the privilege of the winning fan. It was just a fun game to watch going back and forth. And it was never out of hand for either team. And there weren't so many penalties that were like just stopping the clock, you know, just stopping the gameplay every 2 seconds.
I mean, I'm getting high on the Seahawks supply right now, but by record, I mean, they're tied with a number of other teams for the best record in the NFL, right? I mean, nobody has a better record than us currently at 2 losses. Patriots lost again. I think Baltimore has 2 losses, one of them to the Browns. Same with the Niners. So, I mean, we are tied with, like, I don't know what it is, like four other teams or something that have the same record. I don't think there's any reason to say that we're not – we have a puncher's chance at getting to the Super Bowl. I mean, who dat say – I'm stealing New Orleans thing now, but, like, who – I mean, I guess maybe New Orleans would be a big – would be a big threat to us right now in terms of, like, you know, who are we worried about right now? I guess, well, Baltimore, but that would be the Super Bowl, and that's the stuff of your nightmare dreams, Andrew, that you were having yesterday.
I was telling Luke yesterday that I went on some weird fan. This is how a Browns fan can get in his head, or this is just how an Andrew can get in his head, but I was taking a shower yesterday, and I think – I'm not trying to say this because I'm Mr. Workout now, but I think my brain is in a kind of a funny place after working out, a place that I usually really enjoy. As you stand in the shower, my brain has – that's good mind-wandering territory there. But somehow in the shower after working out yesterday, I just spiraled into this fantasy of the Seahawks losing to the Ravens in the Super Bowl, which I said that to you and you're like, that'd be great. I'd love to make it to the Super Bowl, but I'm just like, I can't. Like, I can't live through that. I can't have the Ravens beat us. I would rather lose to any other team in the Super Bowl. And for some reason, I just was like, I just was spiraling on that, and it wasn't until like 20 minutes later I feel like I was like, whoa, where did I go? What was that dark fantasy, and how much water have I used?
Yeah, I forget the teams that you hate because they're not the teams I hate, and so they don't matter to me. No, but like the fact that there's the Ravens component, the Steelers component for you, because I'm just kind of like, I'm like, Lamar Jackson is fun to watch, and you know, but of course, if it were the Oklahoma City Thunder, I would have the exact feelings that you have about them being previously the Browns. But yeah,
I mean, they're also divisional rivals and just like a bad rivalry that we just have not really gotten on top of. It is astounding that one of the Ravens' losses was to the Browns this year. And of course, we'll face them again, and that will not go as well for us. But
well, yeah, probably not. I mean, honestly, I was going to I was going to do my optimism, but you've broken me. You and your do you want to talk about the Browns, or you just want to talk about rollerblading?
I do want to talk about rollerblading. I will say, though, only because I started this and then I didn't finish it. So, yeah, next Sunday, the Rams. That's supposed to be – somebody's got a case of the spostas. Do you know that line from The Simpsons? It goes through my head every time somebody says supposed to. But anyway, it's supposedly going to be a Sunday night game unless they flex us again. And by the way, if they flex us again, I will not be able to watch the Seahawks game live next week, because I had to – the last time we had a scheduled Sunday night game, I was scheduled to volunteer that day, and then I basically said, I can't do this anymore, and somebody filled in for me. I'm not doing that again. I'm not putting the NFL's schedule changes ahead of my volunteering. So I hope that the NFL will just stick with the Rams versus the Seahawks on Sunday Night Football next week.
Well, I mean,
not to be cocky, but, you know, the Rams, that's less nervous making than the Vikings, right? Or should I?
Oh, no, way more for me. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm right about this, but like what I said last week was, the Rams are going to always be good in my mind until they have like three or four abysmal seasons. Like, as long as they have Todd Gurley, as long as they have Jared Goff, as long as they have Aaron Donald, as long as they have Cooper Kupp, I'm going to be like, ugh. Like, to go to LA and play that team, it's very explosive. They're a very explosive team sometimes. And so, no, I don't think that game is a gimme at all, even though their record is not awesome.
Not a gimme, but let's rewind to 4 days ago before this win over the Vikings. You look at the schedule. Would you then have been more nervous about the Rams than the Vikings?
Yes, I wasn't worried about the Vikings. In fact, at my own peril, I was like, I just figured, I don't know, we have the Vikings number. I thought Kirk Cousins was going to screw it up, and we're playing at home. So I wasn't worried about that game. I probably should have been more worried than I was. Going on the road against the Rams gives me the bad feeling. You remember when you and I watched, I don't know where we were going, we watched like the end of a Rams-Seahawks game from SeaTac, like standing.
Oh, yeah. We started that at the Eagles. Yeah.
Standing next to a bar and like in SeaTac, and it was like, it came down to like clock management, and I think we were out of timeouts, and it was like a fourth and one. It was just some real heartbreaker of a game. That's happened a lot against the Rams in the last few years for the Seahawks. So I have a lot of PTSD around the Seahawks playing the Rams.
Yeah, the Rams have beat the Saints. They lost handily to the Buccaneers. This is pretty early in the season, though. And, of course, we beat them once. And they lost to the 49ers. I'm just trying to get a sense of what they've accomplished and whether or not their record says it all. But, you know,
I think they've played record, a tough – I think they've actually played a tough yeah. record.
Yeah,
and also, I think it comes down to Todd Gurley's health. If Todd Gurley is healthy, or as healthy as he can be anymore, then I think it takes a ton of pressure off of Goff, and it means their offense really clicks. And their defense is – I mean, like, Aaron Donald terrifies me on every level. I mean, he is just a beast, and I feel like he's one of those guys that just, like, he's going to get five sacks, and you just, you hate to see it. Maybe they'll, you know, just, like, triple team, which means, like, somebody else will get four sacks for them. If you put everybody on Aaron Donald, it just makes it easier for somebody else, but I'm really afraid of teams that have a very fierce pass rush, because I feel like that's kind of our Achilles heel. A, our line is not always great, and B, like, Russell took a sack yesterday where he held the ball for 8 seconds. That is, in NFL terms, a lifetime. So Russell's not always the greatest decision maker.
Was that the one where he kept going further back, too, and he just lost his footing at the very end of it, and he gave up, I think, like, nine? Well, I think the next play was, like, it was, like, 3rd and 19 or something.
I think that was the play, and what's funny about it is that I saw on Twitter today, it was being retweeted by, I can't remember who, somebody from Seahawks Twitter, but it was Dwayne Brown getting shade from some NFL watcher. There's this whole weird media, there's this whole pundit class of NFL knowers that are like the Mike Florios of the world. This wasn't Mike Florio, but somebody like that that's just kind of like football analytics guy that I don't know if he's ever coached or played a game, but he's got like 100,000 Twitter followers. And when he lights Dwayne Brown up, Dwayne Brown doesn't like it, because on this play, which I'm trying to watch to refresh my memory, but I'm having to watch a car commercial on this play. I think it was the one where Dwayne Brown was actually getting his helmet pushed back, and then he went to complain to the ref. And then while he was complaining to the ref, as the play was still going on, the guy who Dwayne Brown had been blocking sacked Russell Wilson.
And I did not this guy, that.
Yeah, this guy wrote on Twitter, Dwayne Brown is complaining to the refs during the play, and then his man sacks Russell Wilson, which is not an untrue statement. Dwayne Brown's point was, my helmet was being pushed back, hands to the face, so much that it was literally like coming off, and so that I couldn't really do much blocking. My issues were more related to the guy trying to push my helmet off my head more than like me making a bad decision. That being said, he did kind of like he basically turned around, put his arms up like, what happened to the ref as his guy was then tackling Russell Wilson. So that was not Dwayne Brown's finest moment, even though
the
other guy had
on that are not good, even if he does have a legit excuse.
Yeah. So but anyway, I'm nervous about the Rams, but I'm also feeling very – I feel like this is a team of destiny this year. We just seem to have we've just kind of gelled in this way that – I don't know. It reminds me of the Super Bowl year, the good one.
Was there a bad one? I've been down in my lab.
Doesn't look
in
like
my
anything
memory
to me.
Machine. Yeah.
Yes. So, speaking of your memory machine, any thoughts, comments on the Browns, or should we just leave it alone?
No, I mean, that was the most important and heartbreaking loss of the season. Obviously, the Browns got off to a really slow start, and they've lost in more painful manners. They've also won in more painful manners somehow this season, but this was a really, really important game. Going in, it would have been the first time we swept the Steelers if we had won this game in, I don't know, several lifetimes, or certainly feels that way. And also, not that I've been watching this Browns team this year really clinging to playoff chances, but it's fun. It's fun when your team actually has a chance. And this game, if they had won this game, they would have come out of that with like a 37% chance of at least playing a playoff game, which I've never really seen as an adult, like since I've been following the Browns again as an adult. And to go in and play such a decimated offense that Pittsburgh had with so many injuries, they're playing a third string quarterback. And our defense just couldn't stop them. The Browns got off to a lead. They got a I believe they got a field goal probably on their first drive. They've been pretty good at least getting some sort of score on their first drive. Then they get a touchdown. They're up 10-0. And then, if memory serves, the Steelers then score 20 unanswered points. And eventually the Browns get another field goal. And the final score is 20-13. And it was just like lamenting. I listened to a little bit of post-game stuff or some Browns podcasts yesterday. And it's just like, this was not a game we should have lost to this team. Now, the Steelers' defense is still really good. Their defense is not decimated, and ours is. We you know, obviously Myles Garrett is out. We have some injuries. We're not playing with our full defense. But from an offensive point of view, it just really boggles the mind how you can have so many talented players and we're not winning games. Jarvis Landry caught a lot of exceptional passes again. He got a lot of exceptional catches. OBJ was essentially not there again. It's been a few days, so I can't remember exactly how many times he was targeted, but not enough, I would say. And then our running game is just astonishingly good. I mean, we have these two great quarterbacks.
I love Chubb in the rain.
Yeah, well, you are on the record. But somehow we kind of gave up on the run game in the second half, and it's unclear why, because we should just be winning games based on the Hunt. How do you feel about Hunt in the rain?
Less good. Problematic.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, I mean, we have two just elite running backs, and they were working for us, and then for some reason, I don't know, Freddie Kitchens, who maybe shouldn't be calling plays anymore, if that rings a bell to last season, but I think he gets scared, and I think when we start playing from behind, I think he just thinks he's got to put it all on Baker, and for whatever reason, Baker isn't connecting. I mean, he's connecting with Landry in some cases, but he's not connecting with OBJ, and it's not enough. It's just not enough. And also, Baker isn't protecting the ball the way he should be. He gave up a fumble and gave up an interception, a game-ending interception. And so he hasn't been clutch. So you got to put it on Baker and Kitchens, I think, although I don't know how to feel. It's like, because these losses are so confounding, I don't know who to be mad at. So as I told you, we were in the bar watching the Browns game, and then, you know, I was just feeling really deflated, and all I can do to make myself feel better is to search Freddie Kitchens on Twitter and just scroll through so many hateful tweets saying, fire this guy. And I don't even know if he should be fired. I honestly don't know enough about it, but something is going wrong. Like, something is going wrong. It's not the players. Like, we have the talent. So they started off as a very undisciplined team, just an astonishingly undisciplined team. Seems like we sort of got that in order, but they're not protecting the ball. These just seem like things that should be coached better, and also some of the play calling should be better. And, you know, I'm not calling for Freddie Kitchens' head, but I don't see what the harm is if they fire him after this year. I mean, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think they should fire him probably, because it's the team is not trending in the right direction. That's the problem. It's like, if they're, you know, if they're losing some games, but it feels like they're building something, then it's like, keep him around. But I don't think you're going to lose. I mean, honestly, and you've said this before, it was like they had momentum with Greg Williams. They were building something with Greg Williams, you know, noted terrible person, but still, that was probably the mistake there. The other thing I was thinking about with them, because I was thinking about the Seahawks and, like, Russell Wilson, it's easy to forget that when Russell Wilson came on the team, he was kind of Russell Wilson-y, which is, like, the human embodiment of Marmaduke, but you had these big personalities around him that were not always, like, the greatest, probably, like, locker room guys. Richard Sherman comes to mind. I love Marshawn Lynch, but he's a kind of quirky dude. Like, and now what's happened over time is that pretty much everybody's gone and been replaced by people that clearly look up to Russell Wilson and are fine with his cornballness. By the way, as I said to you last night, miking up Russell Wilson is the least interesting thing you could ever do, and also puts you in the least danger of a swear getting out on national television.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
But there's something about, I think part of why the Seahawks are clicking is because Russell Wilson is surrounded by people that are kind of into his program and into that kind of, like, cheesy optimism. And the way that I think that relates to the Browns is you've got big personalities. OBJ and Landry. Although, by the way, after the Garrett thing, did you happen to watch OBJ and Landry like sitting at that weird desk they set up on the field on the NFL Network doing this interview afterwards? It was really touching, actually. Like,
really?
They're like really legit good friends, and like OBJ really looks up to Landry, which is kind of funny because OBJ is more famous and highly paid, presumably. But OBJ really like looks up to Landry as almost kind of like a big brother slash father figure. He's talking about what he's taught him about being a man and a father these things. Like it was weird because it was happening. There was so many strange things happening. One, that Myles Garrett situation had happened. We'll call it the Garrett Rudolph situation. Okay, he's not blameless. But that had happened. And then you have Michael Irvin, noted cocaine enthusiast, among other things, actually the most interesting person on the post-game panel at just like – he was running it because everyone was just so gobsmacked. Even the people from the NFL Network, you know, the other paid, you know, hosts at that desk were all kind of like didn't know what to do. Michael Irvin seems like the kind of guy that when the shit goes down, you want him on your team because he's been through a lot of shit. He'll be like, I know how this goes. I'm not currently hiding out in the back of a strip club smoking crack hoping the barring the door from the police. So this I can handle. A little on the field melee, that I got. Like, he was very cool under fire. He did a weirdly deep and interesting interview with those two guys about what had happened on the field and then about their relationship with each other. And it was like really good television.
Well, I will say, as far as the trending is concerned, I mean, not to correct you, but they did win three in a row, so they were trending in the right direction. Okay. This broke a three-game winning streak. You know, it shouldn't be the end of everything, but it just when this happened in the season, and considering the team they were playing, and it felt like it shouldn't have happened, it feels sort of like a season-ending loss to us. I'm hoping they can win a few. They still haven't faced the Bengals, who have been rotten this year, and so we still have two Bengals games in front. Am I right about that? Yeah, two Bengals games in front of us. So, you know, hopefully there are some more wins in the future, and then that will impact the Freddie Kitchens thing. But back to the Landry OBJ thing, I think I mentioned this in a previous No Point, but there was a few games back. It would have been, I think, their last loss before the winning streak. It was confounding because, again, OBJ wasn't getting targeted at all. I mean, it was the storyline of the week after that game. Like, what is going on? And there was a moment where he was, open in the end zone, and he didn't get a look from Baker. And you saw, you know, the networks love those narratives, so they're showing him on the sidelines looking kind of agitated. Not as agitated as Richard Sherman, but, like, you know, he looks pissed off. Like, and you don't want him to be, like, pissed off at the quarterback. You don't – ugh, I hate that. I hate that when you're rooting for a team and there's infighting and they feel like, you know, you don't want a poisonous relationship between your quarterback and your wide receiver. And he said in the press conference, either the press conference or on-field interview immediately after the game, he's like, no. Yeah, you throw to Landry. Landry's an amazing wide receiver. And I was just like, I was so happy to hear that we weren't going to be going into a week of coverage of OBJ is mad at Baker and Landry for cutting him out. He's like, no, yeah, if you can throw to Landry, you should throw to Landry because he's an amazing wide receiver. And that's – you love hearing stuff like that.
Yeah, and that story checks out after I saw those two talking on camera about they, I think they really do – have a really good relationship, and they're not probably battling each other for throws or like begrudging the other one if they make a good catch. I just mean the thing sometimes I feel like football is such a weird sport because it's sometimes things are less than the sum of their parts. And I feel like the Browns are kind of doing that when they're not playing well. It's like you have this quarterback who's shown some real promise. You have these two receivers that are world class. You have this running back who's amazing. Two running backs that are amazing. You have some guys on defense, particularly Myles Garrett, who are incredible. And so it's like you add all these things up, and it should equal 10, and sometimes it equals like 3. And it's like if you take those guys and put them on different teams, I think you get different production out of them. So I guess what I'm saying, this isn't really a should Freddie Kitchens be fired answer, but it's more like, I don't know, they might need to get some role players or something. Like I just feel like it's a combo of very big personalities that are making a lot of money, and that can create some challenges.
Yeah, well, and again, whether it's Kitchens or somebody else, I think that they need to make some sort of coaching changes. Like, it definitely seems like Baker has taken a step back in his sophomore year. That shouldn't be happening. So I don't know who the Browns quarterback coach is. I'm looking for it here. Is it Ryan Lindley? I honestly don't know. But no, I think maybe he's the running backs coach. But I don't know, something, whoever is talking to Baker, I think that like we need to fix the Baker problem. Which, by the way, he did not look as. I mean, listen, he needs to protect the ball more. He made some bad decisions and some bad passes, but he did not look as bad as he did at the beginning of the season. The beginning of the season, he just looked like he didn't know. Well, he looked like he only knew one thing to do with the ball every time he had the ball, which was whatever was drawn up, get it out of your hands as fast as possible, throw it like a bullet to whatever receiver was drawn up, and just hope that they're in the clear and hope that you're not throwing it between their hands. And he's shown a lot more finesse and comfort in the pocket. Our O-line is problematic, though, and it just there's not a lot of protection going on. And I feel like it, even some of his some like that fumble and maybe even that interception, I don't think he needs to take full responsibility of it because he's not getting protected. He didn't have 8 seconds to, well, I guess that ended up in a sack with Russell, but like he has no time back there.
Yeah.
So anyway, it would be good to see maybe a better O-line to protect him more, but also maybe if they can bring in somebody who can get Baker on the right track again, because he's a very talented young man who should be at the very beginning of hopefully a long career in Cleveland, but we need to get him connecting because clearly the answer isn't bringing in better targets.
Right, exactly. And that's where, I mean, this has long been my theory about all football. It's so unsexy, but you just, if you have a super solid offensive line, everything else works. Because there is every NFL level quarterback, if you except that one play with Russell Wilson, if you give them 8 seconds, they will throw completions because they can't cover guys that long. And running backs, even average running backs, will do well if there are holes for them to run through. It's like, it's no fun when your team drafts a guard. Like, you want a fun receiver or something. You want a DK Metcalf. But it's like, I think every NFL team, maybe it's just that there's a finite number of competent linemen. Because it's like a weird, it's like you almost shouldn't exist physically. You shouldn't be that big, but also that coordinated. And your body's in constant rebellion. It's why your tendons are always snapping every time you try to, like, backpedal and block Aaron Donald or whatever. But it's like, yeah, the Browns, I think if they shore up their line, I bet Baker gets better. I bet everything kind of gets better if they can do that.
By the way, I had a Google search sitting here in front of me trying to figure out the quarterback's coach. Well, it is Lindley, Ryan Lindley, and I didn't realize this, but Jarvis apparently got into it with the quarterback coach right after the game. Again, the Browns game ended with an interception by Baker that I assume was intended for Landry, but honestly, I don't remember the details. And it says that after that play, Landry got into a heated exchange with quarterback's coach Ryan Lindley on the sidelines immediately after the Joe Hayden pickoff. By the way, Joe Hayden, of course, a former beloved Brown. I actually like, you know, Browns fans have a you know, they're known as being pretty tough fans, right? Mm-hmm. But the way they sent out Joe Hayden when he left the team was really nice. Like, they didn't get all bitter and mean about it. Like, I think Browns fans still like Hayden, even though he left to go to their rival, their division rival. And I think it just speaks to Hayden being such a good man and like a big booster of Cleveland during his time there. So that was some, I don't know, poetic injustice,
bitter,
I guess,
irony.
Him picking off to end the game. But yeah, apparently Landry got in the quarterback coach's face to talk about whatever miscommunication went on there. So anyway, again, I don't know enough about this shit, but they need to shake something up to figure out what's going on. And I think part of it has to do with the coaching, if not the head coaching.
Yeah. Well, I'm rooting for him. It was fun on Sunday watching that. I mean, even though they didn't win, it was fun watching that game at that bar just to see all those Cleveland fans. I mean, they seem like a good group of folks, and it's like you guys deserve some happiness in this world. So,
yeah.
I'm rooting for you. All right, I guess that's going to do it this week.
Oh, wait, hold on. One last thing, though. I wanted to ask you, first of all, we never talked about the Apple Cup, which I think was, how am I already losing that? Oh, the Apple Cup. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. But then also, I wanted to know how you feel about Coach Peterson leaving the Huskies. Do you have a second to weigh in on that before we go?
I do have a second to weigh in on all of those things. And the listeners were like, oh, God, it was almost over. And now.
I know. Sorry, guys.
More of it's happening. Well, let's start with the Apple Cup. We could do a lot of time on just Mike Leach and his press conference where he called that columnist a bitter troll or whatever. That was pretty funny. But the Apple Cup, it was, you know, a relief to win, but it's cold comfort because it's like this has been a real, for the Huskies, I feel like this has been kind of a wasted season. They had a lot. I think what we didn't realize about them going in was they lost pretty much everybody good on defense, like to the NFL. They had a really good defense last year, and then they graduated a bunch of those guys. And they were starting at one point, I think, like, I mean, the 90% of the defense was like freshmen or something, so, or sophomores. So that hurt us more than we were expecting. And then Eason had a very uneven season as well. So it was nice to win the Apple Cup, but it was kind of like, okay, cool, we're 6-4. We're bowl eligible for the, like, you know, Poulon Weed Eater Bowl or something. which brings me to the Chris Peterson thing. I'm totally not sad that he stepped down. Like, I like Chris. I like what he did for the program. I think he made us relevant again. And, I mean, if you look at his stats, it's actually pretty sick. He has the highest, between Boise State and Washington, he has the highest winning percentage of any, I think that it's only maybe Dabo Sweeney at Auburn has a higher winning percentage than him, but he has a higher winning percentage than Nick Saban during that same period of time. Now, granted, that was because he was at Boise State running the table for a long time. Boise State would, like, win every game because they were in, like, the Mountain West or something. But yeah. I think Chris Peterson, he did more than you could have ever asked him as a coach in terms of getting us to the Final Four playoff, winning the conference a couple of times, making the program legit again. But I don't think we were going to get over the hump with him. Now, Jimmy Lake, the guy that's taking over for him, was our defensive coordinator. Our defense has been our strong suit the last few seasons, and even this year, certainly it wasn't our offense. We were going to lose Jimmy Lake pretty soon. Like, he was a real sort of highly sought after defensive coordinator, which is usually the job you have before you become a head coach somewhere. So I think this was actually an act of unselfishness from Chris Peterson. I think he saw, like, A, I think he was burned out, and B, I think he was like, he likes Jimmy Lake, and he was like, this is a way for me to basically hand, you know, the keys to this guy. And I like the idea of us having a head coach who's really defensive-minded and can – it's fun to have a super fearsome defense, and I think we're going to always have a good defense under Jimmy Lake. And I was consistently –
can I ask you a quick question? Am I please. Remembering, was Lake also kind of talking shit specifically about Leach? Didn't he kind of –
yeah.
So this is kind of like – because I think – well, why don't you just take it over? What did he say? He said something kind of like, oh, good, as long as Leach is calling the plays, like, I got this locked up essentially, right?
It was not this Apple Cup, but last year's. They were interviewing Lake after the game, and he said something to the effect of basically Mike Leach just does the same thing every year, and so I hope he sticks around for a long time. Which is, that's way more shade than coaches really usually throw.
Yeah.
But he wasn't wrong. And, I mean, you know, peace and love to Durs if he's still listening, or our other Coug fans that might be listening. But, like, oh, by the way, it was hilarious. They cut to sad Jim Moore during the broadcast of the Apple Cup. It was so random.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that.
There's, like, 65,000 people in the stadium, and then there was a big play for the Huskies, and they just scan a, like, random Cougar family, and it's Jim Moore. I was like, that's funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, it certainly – Jimmy Lake didn't seem wrong this year when the Cougars kind of did what they do and the Huskies were able to stop them. But as far as the Chris Peterson thing, I was always really frustrated with his performance, his coaching performance in big games. I feel like he's a good recruiter and he's really good at running a good, clean program. But, like, I felt like he – most of the time, whether it was a big bowl game or just a big – pressure-packed game, even in the conference, I feel like the team it was sort of like the opposite of, like, the way the Seahawks are playing this year, where it seems like they just kind of have this weird just luck or extra gear they can kind of go into to get it done. That, like, Huskies have the opposite of that, like,
mm-hmm.
And they seem like they've always had that under Chris Peterson. Like, they win a lot of games and they recruit good players, but, you know, when it comes to, like, the postseason and when it comes to really big, important games during the season, I feel like he's always at his worst. So I'm not really that sad to see him go. He seems like a nice enough guy, and I think he did well by the program. But I'm curious to see what the next phase will be.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I guess I didn't know that about the defensive coordinator. I didn't know much about that at all. So I do wonder if this was 100% his decision or if other people were kind of saying, hey, we're going to lose Lake if you don't step aside pretty soon.
I think it's – well, he had a press conference today, which I didn't watch because we were doing TBTL. But my guess is that it's 100% his decision. I think he had a job for life. I mean, you come and you take this program to the Final Four playoff – like within the first 3 or 4 years you're here, you kind of have like a lifetime job, I think, unless you just like absolutely lose it for like multiple seasons. And he's not an old guy. He's 55 years old, and he's obviously very like trim and fit. He probably exercises. Like he's not one of those like, you know, he's not a Freddie Kitchens. Like he doesn't look like he's going to have a coronary infarction at any moment. My sense is that he just has, you know, he doesn't need to work anymore. He's made enough money. Not that that's why he got into coaching, but it's like he doesn't have financial pressure. And I think it's probably just like the pressure of the day in, day out pressure of coaching a major program really wears on a person. And I think he probably was like, there's other ways for me to get the good parts of my job, i.e. teaching football to young people or mentoring or whatever he's into, some boring ass shit. like, I mean, he's, I mean, that guy is the most, like, he is the most rigid dude I've ever seen. I heard this story yesterday that, like, there was a Huskies beat writer who had his cell phone. And this is a normal thing. There's, like, usually a couple of the very senior writers, they're allowed to occasionally text the coach and ask a question. It's kind of like a, you know, it's a perk of being there a long time. And one of these guys was, like, texting very occasionally Chris Peterson and was told by the athletic director, never do that again.
Really?
Yeah, he's not like Mr. Fun Guy. But again, that's not his job to be Mr. Fun Guy. But
yeah.
So I don't think he was pushed. I think he just was just burned out. He also said something really interesting, which to – I forget who wrote this. I saw this online somewhere. But it was actually the guy who's the new like play-by-play dude for the football team said that Chris Peterson had sort of mentioned to him that he wished that college football coaches could get a sabbatical. That, like, there was some way that you could basically take a year off, recharge, and then come back and still have your job, which is a really interesting notion. Because it's sort of a non-starter if you think about how football works. But why? Like, if you have a really good coach, and in order for them to coach, let's say, for 12 years, they need 2 of those years to just be recharge years. I don't know. Are you better off, you know, getting the 12 years out of him or whatever? So that was an interesting – I think he just needed a break. And now will he come back somewhere else? Who knows? But I don't get the sense anyone was telling him that he needs to step down to make room for Jimmy Lake.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And it definitely seems like – because I saw some tweets coming in as he was doing his press conference. And, I didn't watch it or read the whole thing. But our friend Jessamine was just at the press conference and tweeting it out right before we started recording. And it did seem to be that it – all indicators did sort of seem to point towards burnout.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of burnout, I think we've burned the listeners out on this sports talk, but I've enjoyed it, and that's what matters. So I guess that's.
I hate to say it. I mean, I know we're feeling very smiley football right now, but I got to give the neutral football, the flat mouthed football for the show pick because we only got one win and one loss.
Well, that's the reality of the world we live in. So you gotta stick with the system. You gotta really just like you gotta game plan these things, and you got your first 50 plays drawn out, and you gotta stick to it. Don't get outside of your game plan. And your game plan is that if one of the teams loses and one of the teams win, it's neutral smiley or neutral face. So
yeah, neutral face on the football.
All right. Well, we'll be back here next week with our thoughts on the Seahawks and Browns and whatever else comes up in the world of sport. So thanks for listening. As we like to say at the end of this, no tangent too long.
And no detail too wrong.